Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Ben Eshmade, and here from 2018, we present our three-part series, Ode to Joystick. Sit back and enter a parallel universe of video games music, from the chunky world of 8-bit tunes to the full studio cinematic scores that define the modern immersive gaming experience. So, do you remember the first time you clunked in a cartridge, slid in a cassette, inserted a 5 1/4 or 3 1/2 inch disc, pushed in a sparkling data CD, double-clicked an icon, or simply slid up a button to load or start your favourite computer game? Computer or video games have been with us since the 70s, from their money-gulping origins in the amusement arcade to the invasion of the home computer and the eating up of our pocket money. What accompanied them, soundtracked them, was the most incredible inventive machine melodies, reveling in the limited channels and sounds. Pioneering composers and coders created tunes so annoying, so brilliant, so catchy, so avant-garde, they practically invented their own genre of music. On the first of three editions, we attempt a rough history of video games music and try to unravel an 8-bit tune with a professor, a doctor, and one of the most legendary composers for the Commodore 64. We play some frankly incredible hand-coded melodies that deserve to be remembered or discovered anew. So let's press play on this pod and dial up Dr. Kenny McAlpine. I started by asking why we seem to love that 8-bit sound.
Part of it, I think, is that it's fun. The sound is just loaded with positive association of childhood and carefree play. It's like musical popping candy. And when you hear it, even the harder four-on-the-floor stuff, you can't help but smile. You know, there's an old Steve Martin routine in which he advocates giving out banjos in place of welfare checks. And chiptune 8-bit has something of that quality about it. It's a really fun, upbeat sound that you just can't help but warm to. Even more importantly, the limitations of 8-bit music can be very liberating. Modern computers and software have given us access to music tools that, you know, even 15 years ago were confined to the likes of Abbey Road. They've also brought a form of creative block, the tyranny of choice. Creative procrastination often kicks in when I sit down in front of my PC with a copy of Cubase or Logic. The temptation is to explore the multitude of presets and options just in case that perfect sound that might make a track is hiding in the next menu along. You know, it's just like Devo sang back in the 80s. Freedom of choice is what you got. Freedom from choice is what you want. Now, that's what chiptune can provide. It's an antidote to the overproduced sound of a lot of contemporary music. You get no option but to go right back to the very basics and address the fundamentals that make music engaging and entertaining. There's nowhere for half-baked ideas or weak arrangements to hide. It's electronic music in its rawest, most fundamental state. It's all about simple ideas expressed well.
Next, I climb aboard my pixelated rocket, making it through bad traffic to crash land in Nottingham at the National Video Game Arcade to speak to Professor James Newman, one of its researchers and curators. I join him on a journey around the arcade and the history of video game music.
So we are in the National Video Game Arcade, which is based in Nottingham. We opened almost 3 years ago now. We are currently actually sitting in a room full of sort of 1980s home computers, 8-bit era home computers, very much the sort of things I grew up with. In fact, we have a Commodore 64, which is really one of the first serious computers I ever owned. We used to think about computer and video games as being a very modern, new medium, but they do have a history that dates back many decades. And really one of the things we wanted to do is celebrate that. So to think about those old and new platforms and systems, think about the linkages between the old and the new. So really this is a building that's dedicated to celebrating that culture and drawing attention to the artistry, the craft and the technology that goes into making games. It's really as much about people who make games as it is about, you know, the systems and technologies themselves. And that's one of the things we really wanted to showcase, the idea that people make games, people play games.
This podcast is focusing on computer game music or game music. Interested to get your take on that. I mean, it's obviously a very loaded phrase and also encompasses the idea of sound design.
Yes, video game music has an interesting history, I guess. I think for a lot of people, it will automatically mean a particular period in time, and it's become, I guess, to some extent associated with the 1980s and that sort of 8-bit computer chip tune, as it's sometimes called, aesthetic. So quite lo-fi, characterized by sort of limited polyphony, so lots of techniques, compositional techniques to try and make it sound like you have more notes playing at once, which have come to define a really sort of characteristic sound of game music. So I suppose for many people, that's become what video game music is. But video game music has evolved and changed, and there's been shifts over time, both as technologies have changed, the ways in which game music is produced, the people who produce it have shifted over time. Partly as, you know, it's not just a simple question of technology changing or evolving, but it's certainly the case that, you know, contemporary computing or video game console systems allow the playback of infinitely more complex music than perhaps those in the room we're sitting in now, surrounded by, you know, 8-bit machines. Video game music isn't really a single thing. It's a sort of evolving story, which is a combination of technology, craft, artistry, different producers and composers finding ways of exploiting the sort of tools that they have at their disposal.
So before we get to 8-bit, let's go back probably, I would have thought, at least one step.
Yeah, so I suppose we go right back to the earliest days of computer games. We're thinking really of, so as with lots of things in video games, the very first video game is a sort of much debated topic, but lots of people talk about Space War. So this was a game created in the computer lab at MIT over in the States. It's really important to remember there was no sound, just graphics. And actually the first home video game console, the Magnavox Odyssey, again, no sound at all. Not just limited sound, absolutely no sound. Right. And even graphically quite limited. The Odyssey, as I say, 1972, was able to draw a couple of dots on the screen. The rest of the graphics were created by overlaying sort of mylar sheets or transparent sheets, or literally sticking them onto the television screen. And the box that the Odyssey came in had dice and pencils and pieces
really?
Of paper. Yeah.
Wow.
But no sound. So, which I suppose if you're simulating space games is quite authentic. But so really sound comes a little bit later, but it is important to remember that they were a sort of visual and interactive medium before they were a sort of sonic medium. But once we get into the arcade, I suppose game music in the arcade performs a number of different functions. So it is definitely catchy melodies that are associated with the game, and sound effects that help you understand what's happening. You collect a coin, it makes a coin jangling sound, just like a real coin doesn't. So there's definitely a kind of signposting of gameplay. But one of the things that sound does in the arcade is it just shouts out, put your 10p or your dollar, whatever it might be, 10 cents into the slot. So you get these things called attract sequences. So one of the really neat things about arcade is that cacophony of every machine shouting at you, saying, no, play me, play me. So these little sort of repetitive jingles that are accompanied with little animation sequences. Yeah, so, you know, lots of games will have these kind of sequences that will effectively show you how to play them, and they sort of showcase themselves. And those jingles and that sort of riot of sound is very much the sound of walking into an arcade. It's quite a confusing space initially. And then you stand next to the machine, and that's, you become absorbed and get sort of, you know, caught up in the flow of playing. And that's then the only sound you can hear. And somehow you manage to sort of hear, filter out these 30 other machines all playing in different times and keys. And...
Jerry, video games are the latest craze to sweep the country and most of the world, too. Millions of people are addicted to hours of gazing at electronic images on game screens and arcades.
It is a cacophony of sounds from a symphony of electronics. If you're filling your time capsules these days, don't forget a bit of Frogger, or Mousetrap, or Grand Champion, or Pac-Man, or Ms. Pac-Man.
The tendency in the, I guess, the 80s, the, one of the things you wanted was to bring the arcade into your home. So to have a version of Space Invaders or Pac-Man or, you know, whatever the sort of game, the game of note was. So to convert those games isn't just a simple question. I mean, if you, you know, you can lug it into your living room, but for most people that's not a serious proposition. So you start to see the emergence of games consoles, things like the Atari VCS or 2600, as it's sometimes known, and the sort of staple of many of the sort of, you know, the early years of that, of systems like that, were arcade conversions. So this is trying to take the essence of the gameplay, the essence of the graphics, and the essence of the sound, and turning that into reprogramming, recoding that arcade original for this new system. Really importantly, though, that new system has different processing capabilities, different graphics capabilities, and different sound capabilities. So those games don't necessarily sound the same. And something like the Atari VCS, incredibly popular, extraordinarily influential console that really, it didn't invent, but it certainly popularized the idea of the game platform. So that's a system that has sort of removable cartridges. So rather than, you know, having a machine that just plays Space Invaders, you have a machine that can play any game, and you keep, you know, you buy a new cartridge and you, you know, swap it out, and you've got a whole new, effectively a whole new system. Challenging sound chip to work with. So it's great for sort of experimental music. It's less good for playing a jingle from Pac-Man, for example. So you, there's a number of different techniques you can use there. You can either just really walk towards that and you can have incredibly atonal music that even today you listen to and it slightly sets your teeth on edge. Oh, so the Atari 2600 is great at making engine noises and raspy explosions. It's not a composer's dream necessarily. So there's various techniques that composers start to use to sort of overcome sometimes the limitations of those systems. But yeah, that notion of converting the game, you very much have the idea that the game console is a sort of, you know, is a facsimile of the arcade, your original, which has the, you know, that's the version, that's what it's supposed to sound like. And then the console conversion is a sometimes, you know, inferior, but certainly a facsimile.
Are you keeping up with the Commodore? Because the Commodore is keeping up with you.
The world's number one selling home computer is now in a family pack, the Commodore 64, plus data cassette and joystick, four software programs including Introduction to Basic, a teach-yourself program for the whole family. The Commodore 64 family pack, a value of $700 for just $499.
Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you.
What you start to see is the emergence of maybe slightly more capable gaming systems, either consoles or home computers, which have slightly more sophisticated sound chips, perhaps. And what you really start to find is composers, musicians starting to be drawn to writing game music, and writing game music that really suits the abilities of the systems. I think perhaps the best example of this is the Commodore 64, you know, 1980s home computer with a sound chip inside it called the SID chip, the sound interface device. Which is essentially it's a synth. It just doesn't have a wooden box and a bunch of keys. So you have to program it by programming hexadecimal. What you start to see is that composers start to write pieces of music that really suit the capabilities that the SID chip in this case has. So they're writing for the chip, almost writing for the silicon, rather than taking a piece of music and then trying to convert it and translate it into, you know, three channels of square wave.
At this point, I think we should speak to one of the most prolific games composers of the 80s, who mainly wrote for the Commodore 64 and its SID chip, Rob Hubbard. He drew influences from everywhere, from classical music to the pop charts, from Scott Joplin to Cabaret Voltaire. He even sampled himself. But the music was very much his own, as he mutated the melodies, coding and composing everything by hand. Go, 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 go.
I got into computers in the early 80s. I was very much into synths and stuff, so I thought, well, I better get one of these machines. Started learning about the machine and programming. I was commissioned to write a game for a company, and just as I was finishing the game, the company went out of business. Typical thing that happened back in the very early 80s. And then they thought the game was absolute rubbish, but they thought music was good. And so I thought, well, maybe there's a niche for me to exploit just doing the music, because a lot of the music was pretty ropey at the time. So I then set about doing some kind of demo tapes and stuff. And I went through all the magazines and got all the addresses and telephone numbers of the publishers and software developers. And it took about 6 months before I got a reply. And then, to cut a long story short, eventually I did get a job. People heard that, and then I got a couple more jobs, and then everything just kind of snowballed, really. A couple of the early ones, like there was a game called Thing on a Spring, a game called Monty on the Run, which people kind of really took notice of those two games. And then there was a game called Commando, Crazy Comets. People really liked those tunes as well. And that kind of basically set the snowball in motion. And it was quite unique to, for a musician, be paying like 50 quid a gig or something to suddenly, you know, start earning, you know, 300 or 400 quid for doing a game, doing the music. You know, from a very traditional background, so I use score paper and I used to sketch out ideas. Mainly, one of the reasons I sketched them out was because sometimes I wanted to get it down on paper as soon as I could, so I didn't actually forget the idea that I. And secondly, having something sketched out on paper, I needed that as a reference because of the way that I had to code it. So it was all hexadecimal notation. 8-bit computers can hold a data size of 8 bits, which is gives you a value of 0 to 255. So a crotchet would be a 7, and then a quaver would be a 3, and then a minim would be a 15 value, and then all the notes were basically hexadecimal numbers. It wasn't as bad as what you think it is, you know. You get into the swing of things. I mean, the most it would generally take a couple of days, maybe 3 days to do a project, because there was, you know, maybe a main tune and then a high score tune and maybe a couple of other little stingers, as it were, and then a bunch of maybe 20 sound effects or something like that. It was something that had to be done. I mean, to be honest, it was always a bit of a pain in the ass, you know. because I was always much more interested in music side of things. Sometimes you got lucky with sound effects and you would stumble across a sound that was actually quite reasonable, you know. Other times it was just trying to knuckle down and do the best you could. During the 80s, I really wasn't aware of a lot of things that were going on. In some respects, I was that busy trying to get those, you know, all my work done, because I didn't know if the work was going to dry up or the games business was going to fold. So I had the mindset that, well, I've got to just keep going with this and run with it for as long as it's going to last, because I thought it was maybe just a fad, a fashion thing which would be taken over by something else. I'd always, you know, had a broad musical background, and I've always spent a lot of time listening to music, and I think that you absorb things. So for me, it was always about trying to come up with a melody and a bass line first, and the melody was basically something that you more or less could be sung or made sense musically. So, you know, I've got various sequences and phrases and answer phrases, common tone modulations and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the other thing that I did, I was conscious that somebody would load these games and the tune would just, if it was short and just had a couple of, like, little A section and a B section, it was going to drive people nuts. So I deliberately set out to do more complex kind of tunes that had, like, A, B, C, D, and an E and an F section. Some developed over time. Some of these things ended up being 10 minutes long, not just like a 3-minute tune. The electronic one that stands up is a game called Sanction. Everybody seems to love that. I didn't like it when I first did it, but it grew on us, which was a little strange. But that one seems to stand up. Well, I mean, people used to say, I only bought the game because of your music. And I used to say, oh, yeah, right, you know, next. I never believed any of that stuff, you know. I mean, I've had such a lot of other, you know, nice comments and people saying things that it's, you know, it's validated a lot of what I did, and you know, makes me a lot more proud of what I did.
Let's pause here and return to Kenny McAlpine and ask about the different musical approaches between European and Japanese composers.
It's a good question, but I'm not sure that you can really directly compare the Japanese and the UK composers of that period, because their mindsets and their approach to composition were really quite different. You know, it's maybe a bit like trying to compare the very best of punk with the very best of prog rock. They're both fascinating, but in very different ways. You know, typically in the UK, the approach was to create complexity by pushing beyond the constraints of the hardware. And composers like Rob Hubbard and Fred Gray developed an array of different compositional techniques and, crucially, bespoke machine code to do just that. Multiplex different musical lines, fitting the notes of one musical part into the spaces left by the rests of another, for example. They would arpeggiate or toggle chords, switching rapidly between the different notes of the chord on one single channel to create harmonic depth, while still leaving room in the composition to have melody, bass, and percussion happening round about it. Koji Kondo, on the other hand, the composer of Super Mario Brothers on the NES, took the opposite approach. You know, rather than push the hardware beyond its limits, he wrote music that would make a feature of its strengths. In particular, he stripped the harmony back to its fundamentals using shell voicings, a technique that's got more in common with the jazz piano music of Bill Evans and Art Tatum than it does with the music of Rob Hubbard. And he focused on getting the most out of just two or three channels. Instead of trying to create harmonic richness, he looked to the rhythm to create complexity, introducing sophisticated syncopations and polyrhythms similar to those of Debussy. Now, on top of that, Kondo was one of the first video game composers to really explore the idea that video game music might work functionally like film music, tightly tying in the action to the gameplay, which is a far from trivial task when you throw player interaction into the mix, and you can't predict in advance what music cues might be needed and when. Kondo's approach to light, open orchestration and rhythmic complexity was really as much a function of the technical requirements of getting the music to work effectively with the gameplay as it was any sense of personal musical style. Now, it's no less innovative or musically interesting, it's just different.
We've got a Nintendo entertainment system in front of us. Where does that come into the sort of the timeline?
Yeah, so we're talking, so in the UK and in Europe, this is so mid-80s, 1987. It was actually released slightly earlier in Japan and the US in 1985. So the means of connection, obviously the NES, Nintendo Entertainment System, as a television-connected console, doesn't have any speakers built into it, so all the audio and video relies on the television display, which means that there isn't really a kind of definitive reference point for what the thing sounded like. It rather depends on, you know, what kind of television you have your NES plugged into. So if you have a television with a tiny little mono speaker in the front, you get a particular quality of sound. If you have it plugged into a wonderful stereo sound system, then it sounds altogether different. Typically for consoles of this sort of age would be radio frequency. So they would be, you know, it's the same connection that you have to connect your television to the, you know, to the aerial to pick up TV. So it's obviously one of the biggest selling consoles. It's, you know, tens of millions of devices have been sold worldwide, and it's home to, you know, games like Super Mario Brothers and The Legend of Zelda. So it's really the beginning of, you know, Nintendo's journey into the home. But ultimately, you're still talking about a device which is capable of making four noises at once, really, in its barest sense. There's also a lo-fi sample playback channel as well. So it's something like the Mario soundtrack, for example, which is, you know, widely known, highly influential soundtrack. It's worth remembering as well that those four channels, those two, you know, the melody, counter melody, the bass line, the rhythm, that's not just the music, that's got to create all the sound effects as well.
Yeah.
So one of the things you notice about playing a game like Mario is every time you jump, there's a jumping sound to tell you that you've jumped. That cuts out the music. So that cuts out, in fact, on Mario Brothers, it cuts out the main melody. So every time you press jump, the lead line for the music disappears, because all of the sound duties, music and sound effects, all have to be produced by those, you know, those four channels. That sound chip is working very hard. And what you certainly see is that those musical motifs are absolutely at the heart of defining what Nintendo NES is. It's very difficult to imagine what Super Mario Brothers would be like without hearing that soundtrack in your head. It's so much a part of, you know, of what that game is and how we've come to understand it. And actually, I think there's certainly stories of Koji Kondo, who's the composer of is one of Nintendo's most prolific composers, but certainly worked on, you know, the early Mario series, having written a piece of music and then seeing the gameplay and realizing, oh, this doesn't work at all, and then having to go back and sort of tailor the music because the tempo is wrong. So I think, yeah, the motifs, But even the style of composition is something, you know, distinctively Nintendo that is absolutely a part of their sort of heritage. And they still, you know, they still reference it in their games today, just as they reference the sort of 8-bit graphics in their current generation of, you know, Switch Mario Odyssey games. The soundtrack is referenced as well. It's a key part of what Nintendo-ness and Mario-ness is. When you talk to musicians, they weren't necessarily expecting their work to be played in concert halls in 20 years' time.
Which they are, absolutely.
So whether they were necessarily thinking the music would have the longevity or would be repurposed and reused in this, in these ways, possibly not, no. You know, musicians were bringing craft and artistry and very aware that they were producing pieces of music that were in many ways much more sophisticated than they needed to be. And you would certainly see in the sort of magazine culture of the 80s and 90s, composers would be interviewed and talked about in the same way as game designers would be as well. So there was definitely, there was always an interest in game music. There was always a fandom that surrounded this, their work. You see it at the time and you see it in reminiscences subsequently. Many is the player who purchased a game for the soundtrack alone. Had really no intention of ever playing the game and no particular interest in playing the game, but would follow those composers' work. So, so you would, you know, the way of finding out what Martin Galway was producing or David Whittaker was producing was to buy that game. I've certainly bought, you know, games where my only reason for buying them was that I'd read a review, it said it had a soundtrack by a composer I really liked, and my first reaction was to put the game in and record it onto my cassette recorder so I could listen to it on my Walkman. I then took the cassette and probably put it on the shelf and never played the game again. So I've no idea what the game is actually like to this day.
Behind you in a cabinet, I can see, all kinds of technology. But the one that I wanted to centre on was the Game Boy, because we've been talking about Nintendo, and one thing we can't get away from is Tetris.
Yes,
and possibly the biggest earworm of the games world.
So the Game Boy has some really interesting qualities as well. So it's related to the Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES, that we were... That we can see across the way that connects to a television. Obviously, the Game Boy is a handheld system, has a built-in speaker, and also has a headphone jack as well. So it's much more of a sort of defined platform. You can it's easier to say what a Game Boy sounds like because the sound comes out of its speaker. It's harder to say what it sounds like though because there's so many different iterations of the Game Boy, and they all sound a bit different. So this version here is the original, so-called DMG-1. This is the first edition, the big sort of grey house brick size thing. Considered by many people to have the best quality sound. It's got a really sort of rich, deep bass, comparatively low noise. There are lots of revisions and iterations of this system. And it sort of reminds you that rather than a CD playing back on a CD player, what we have here is a device where the music is played back in real time on a chip. It's being generated real time, and it effectively a synthesizer built in. So the combination of that, the way that synthesizer's been designed, all the internal wiring, the speaker, all of those things directly affect the way, you know, the music's going to sound. It's code that's being played back in real time on a sound chip.
Down one floor in the arcade. Where are we in regards to the sort of the progression of technology and how that affected the games, the music?
So we're in the Hall of Inputs, as we call it. So this is a gallery space dedicated to different input devices. What we're looking at here is PlayStation, Sony PlayStation, and the game in particular we're thinking about is something called VibRibbon. So PlayStation mid-90s console, one of the distinctive features of the PlayStation is it has a CD-ROM drive. So one of the things that allows you to do from a musician's point of view is to start to play back, you know, standard CD audio. So this opens up a whole raft of different possibilities. Rather than the music being sort of programmed and played back on a sound chip, so you're not really beholden on the abilities of the system to play back a certain number of pitches or different types of waveforms or the particular sound of the filter in that system. So what that means is you start to get a couple of things. One is you get licensed music. So one of the launch titles for the PlayStation in the UK was a game called Wipeout. Which had a soundtrack that was...
So
it's a kind of futuristic racing game. So you have sort of hover cars. PlayStation was very much about 3D, so it was a game where you sort of raced into the screen, and rather than a car, you had a futuristic sort of hovering vehicle. The game really sort of picked up on that sort of zeitgeist of popular music and club culture from the sort of early to mid-90s. So the game graphics, or the sort of iconography, was designed by the Designers Republic, whose work you'd probably have seen on an Orb album. And the soundtrack was licensed music that included tracks from the Chemical Brothers or Orbital.
Wow.
So you start to see then this real connection between video gaming and club culture. And you get PlayStations we put in, you know, super clubs like Cream and Ministry of Sound. So you start to associate gaming. I wouldn't say it necessarily became chic, but it certainly became more cool than it was. And that was certainly something Sony were very much trying to do. Part of the reason they could do that is by having the CD-ROM drive. So rather than having cartridges or cassettes, we were talking about, the CD-ROM drive allows data to load, the game data to load, but also then a portion of that CD-ROM is effectively is an audio CD. And so with that, different kinds of game making opportunities come along. So VibRibbon, created by a musician, Japanese musician, and game developer Masaya Matsura. So VibRibbon takes advantage of the fact that once you've loaded the sort of game data from the PlayStation CD-ROM, not only could you play audio from the CD portion of that disc, you could actually take that disc out and replace it with your own CD. So what this game does, you could put any CD into this game, and it starts to generate a landscape based on the sort of audio analysis of the CD as it's playing. So each one of the obstacles that you have to leap over is generated by analysing the waveform of the CD. So your music is not only playing, but it's generating the level at the same time as well. So this is something you just couldn't do before, without the that CD-ROM and CD playback technology. Yeah, so there's a sort of class of game which, like VibRibbon, where music is absolutely central, where the music is helping generate the level. There's another kind of game where you're basically playing a sort of simplified musical instrument, and your performance is the thing which is which is being kind of measured and turned into a game. So things like Guitar Hero, you have a small replica guitar becomes the controller. So you have a little sort of a device that simulates strumming. You have four or five buttons on the fretboard of the guitar. And you see this sort of style of gameplay that starts to happen. It's a little bit like a piano roll from a sequence, or maybe like a sort of tracker dropping down, notes are dropping down the screen. And you have to press these buttons, in time as they appear on the screen. It's, the harder levels get impossibly hard. And there was lots of sort of speculation about whether people who are really, really good at Guitar Hero are going to be really, really good guitarists.
Yeah, I was wondering that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how transferable a skill it is, because the thing, so you get, there's a level of dexterity, certainly, but I think what you do is you get really, really good at Guitar Hero. But it does make the idea of music and performance, it brings that into the home in a way that perhaps if you presented somebody with a guitar and said, right, now learn that, that might not be as appealing. So this idea of sort of gamifying, there's certainly a kind of interesting development there that we see. And that moves from being guitars to entire, a series like Rock Band that has rhythm guitar, lead guitar, bass guitar, and a drum kit even. So we start to see a range of different instruments, to the point where it actually becomes almost like band rehearsal just to set the game up. You need a physically large space to set up all of your virtual instruments. And such was the popularity of those types of games that stores opened up behind them. So really, things like SingStar for singing, but Rock Band and Guitar Hero, there were special editions that you could buy for your favourite band, but actually inside them is effectively a music store. So if you want other tracks, you can pay a small or large amount of money, depending on the arrangement, download some more tracks and play along with them. Mm. So sort of significant a market was that. I think the first time the Beatles catalogue was made available outside of CD, but in sort of digital format in that way, was in the Beatles Rock Band. So you got your beautiful replica Hofner bass, and you could listen to that music. In fact, some of the work that went into separating out some of those channels of the original Beatles recordings as well is absolutely stunning. Get back to where you
once belonged. Get back.
That's small. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
This subject is big. I mean, the more you dig into it, the more you find. So probably jumping a few steps, but where are we now? We haven't really touched on the PC. There's the mobile phone, obviously. Yeah, and then there's the latest generation of all the consoles.
Yeah. So there's a large span of platforms. I guess one of the things that's sort of distinctive about this moment is the range of different systems, the range of different places where we might encounter games and play them. Yeah, so the current generation of sort of PCs and consoles, technologically, we sort of, to some extent, have sort of moved beyond that period in the 80s and 90s where each sound chip offered something maybe that the previous one didn't, or had a distinctive sound. Yeah, the ability to replay, many, many hundreds of channels from a sound chip, or to directly stream multi-channel audio from disc, is a fairly sort of common feature across different console platforms and PC as well. So what we start to see is things like surround sounds becoming more prominent. So comparatively recently, it's often possible to play back surround sound in what we call cutscenes, so the kind of the movie style intermissions between between gameplay. The ability to play back surround sound in real time, so to have positional audio, so audio that's moving around you that you can use for cues, thing happening behind you over your shoulder. So certainly things like that in the sort of console and PC space are really interesting developments. And I guess VR is one of really interesting places and spaces to think about sound design. I think it's typical to think about VR as being a visual medium, but actually it's the sound that often is used to direct players' attentions. So in VR, what do you do if you want a player to look over their shoulder? You have a big sign that says look over your shoulder. Now it's a bit intrusive. So things like having audio or music cues that are positioned in three-dimensional space. So interestingly, VR is as much a sort of audio environment, and it's exciting in terms of sound as it is in terms of visuals. And quite what happens in VR, that's still being kind of improvised and made up. So does sound travel with you as you move your head around? Does it stay located in a particular place and you move your head relative to it? All of those kind of techniques are still being improvised, but it's certainly a really exciting time to be a game musician. The tools are incredibly flexible. I guess the sort of flip side of that is there's almost too much choice.
Yes.
And so I think to some extent we might see sort of harking back to maybe a simpler time, which might explain some of the popularity still of older gaming systems and sound. So while we're thinking, in 2018, it's tempting to think about what comes next, because that's generally the way gaming works. It's all about next generation and, technological sophistication and things improving. What's interesting is to see the revisiting of 8-bit aesthetic and the sort of, to some extent, the kind of permanence of that it's never really gone away.
No.
There's been this huge fan culture surrounding that music. But what we're starting to see, I guess, is a sort of perhaps a more mainstreaming of that. Popular music really obviously being inflected by game music aesthetics, whether that's sort of compositional styles or the sound of of old gaming hardware. So I think to some extent we're thinking about how game music might develop, but saying some of the ways it develops by looking back at its own history. This stuff is absolutely part of the sort of lexicon of modern electronic music, and the emulations of those devices in software, or the ripping out of chips from home computers and putting them inside modular, you know, pieces of modular equipment. Mm. That stuff is absolutely the kind of centre of, you know, contemporary electronic music making practice. So I think that's why there's a lot of fondness for things like the, you know, the Commodore 64 or the Amiga, is you're thinking about, you know, synthesis and sampling, and that going hand in hand with, you know, sort of music making. And you definitely see that, yeah, that still continues to inflect, you know, popular, yeah, electronic dance music in particular. And to some extent, I mean, you know, in the building, that's one of the things we're interested in doing, is sort of making those connections. It's not just about sort of nostalgia that we think about the Commodore 64. We think about the Commodore 64 because the Commodore 64 is still a music-making device that's used, you know, yeah, today. Yeah.
So I thought at this point it would be fun to ask Kenny's help to pick apart an 8-bit tune and show how incredible they really were. He's chosen Rob Hubbard's Commando.
Now, Commando's soundtrack is interesting on lots of different levels, not least because of the way that the soundtrack came about. So picture the scene. A young Rob Hubbard, all hair and moustache, sitting behind his trusty Casio MT32 keyboard in his Newcastle studio, takes a phone call from the UK software firm Elite. "Can you get on a train to Birmingham as soon as possible?" they ask him. "We need you to do all the sound for our game, which needs to ship in a week." Now, he paused only to pocket a handful of floppy disks and to tuck his keyboard under his arm and set off for Birmingham on the train, arriving just as the office was closing up for the day. So they all headed straight to the pub. They had a few beers and set the world to rights. Eventually, at about 10 o'clock, they headed back to the office to talk about the game. They showed Rob the arcade version, and then they promptly disappeared, leaving Rob alone locked in the office overnight to write the music. Now, that arcade soundtrack is a short military-style march, a no-nonsense melody harmonised in block chords with a flurry of synthesised snare rolls beneath. After that initial theme is introduced, it's transposed up a minor third and then repeated before dropping out completely, leaving a series of snare drum rudiments playing before the whole lot loops again from the beginning. Now, it's not, I think, by any means a bad piece of arcade music, but then neither is it particularly sophisticated or particularly memorable. There's very little variety in the short loop, and the voicing of the block chord harmony creates parallel movement as the tune progresses. Now, parallel motion happens when each note of a chord rises or falls by the same musical interval, and it's one of those things that rookie composers are encouraged to avoid like the plague when they first start to study four-part harmony. Parallel thirds or parallel sixths are okay in moderation, but parallel fifths are a definite no-no. Now, of course, it's a rule that Bach ignored with some regularity, and Debussy's piano work is littered with this stuff. But away from such considered and experienced hands, parallel motion creates a really awkward, heavy-handed sort of musical progression. Rob just simply hated the sound of parallel motion in the arcade soundtrack, and so the first thing he did was to ditch it. He kept the basic melody from the arcade version. Then he took the basic chord progression of the original and turned it into the short hook that really defines the rest of the piece. Now, I think you can hear straight away how different his score is from the original. It's not just a conversion, it's a reinterpretation, one that's designed to make the most of the underlying musical material by using everything that the SID chip had to offer. Breaking that down then, on one channel, he combines a bass line with filtered noise to synthesize a snare drum, slotting in the percussion on the backbeats when there are rests in the bass. He uses ring modulation synthesis and hard sync synthesis, both features that were unique to the SID hardware on the first two channels to create that powerful rhythmic opening. And he uses arpeggiation, rapidly alternating between the melody note and the note an octave higher on the same channel to create a kind of pulsing pitch effect that adds both harmonic depth and a sense of sound in motion. It's a very densely packed couple of bars, and so it's interesting to find a crotch at rest at the end of the second and fourth bars in voice two. Rob rarely left any musical space unused. After the main theme plays through, Rob takes the hook through a series of modulations, always moving in thirds to keep the momentum going. As he works through the changes, he plays with the melodies and counter melodies, adding variations and a driving descending chromatic line that plays against the rhythm of the melody. After that, he brings in a full bore solo before bringing back in little details and musical callbacks to earlier in the piece. In total, around 4 minutes of driving electro rock. By the time he finished up, it was getting on for 8 o'clock in the morning. Before everyone came back in, Rob loaded the music on every one of the C64s that were dotted around the office and turned each one up as loud as he could. Everybody at Elite arrived to a cacophony of commando, and Rob, well, he got on his train and went home.
A teleport now back to the video games arcade for a final thought from James on the legacy of video games music.
Now, this is really about celebrating the fact that even music that originated in the 80s and 90s still has a life today. It still has a meaning today as well. People are still listening to it, but people are reworking it as well. Those compositions are inspiring new composers today. Those sound design techniques are inspiring new sound designers and synthesis today. And those systems and platforms are as meaningful today as they were, actually in many ways more meaningful and more usable. Composers in the 1980s were having to program in hexadecimal with nothing more than just streams of digital. The screen looks like the Matrix when they show you what they were doing, and really celebrating the fact that this is a really rich, creative, dynamic art form. We have really avant-garde sound design that's happening in a lot of these kind of even in those kind of early soundtracks. We see incredible use of things like ring modulation and oscillator sync, and the points of inspiration. It's tempting to think of game music as being sort of cheapy, blippy, bloppy sort of stuff. You hear a composer like Rob Hubbard, for example, talking about the inspiration of Philip Glass's Coroner's Cutscene and his, that those minimalist composition techniques. And you listen to that piece of music in a completely different way. And actually, I think for a lot of people, then Philip Glass becomes opened up and you think, okay, so if Rob Hubbard was using that, let's go and listen to Koinos Katsi, and you realise, crikey, yeah, there's a whole world of composition that perhaps you weren't aware of. So I think game music is often a sort of gateway to thinking about other kinds of composition, other forms of sound design.
My thanks to James Newman, Kenny McAlpine and Rob Hubbard for speaking to me and the National Video Game Arcade for existing and welcoming us into its building. Also, a quick plug for Kenny's book, Bits and Pieces, A History of Chiptunes, which is available now. So, I hope you enjoyed this first trip, an incredible voyage into the 8-bit universe of sound. In the next edition, we meet a range of composers from around the world who have terraformed new planets and star systems with their music, including Winifred Phillips.
It was a slow exploding bomb. The explosion kept getting bigger in my head until it was just what I was obsessed with.
And Nitin Sawhney.
It's important that you get into the gameplay while you're composing to just see how it feels. You're always trying to think, okay, you don't want to kind of have something too obvious or boring.
Joining the bleeps and bloops in this podcast, we heard music from the Where Is My Heart soundtrack by Alexandro Koronas, with in-house audio design from Die Gutter Fabrik of Denmark. I'm Ben Eshmaid. Thanks for listening to this archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. Here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and theme series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out. For now, game over.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.